The notion of a secular democracy is inextricably linked with our ideas of what it is to be modern and liberal. Throughout the 20th century, there seemed to be numerous indications that secularism would continue to be a, if not the, defining feature of Western democracies. But as I've told you, our next guest, Professor Rajiv Bhagava, argues that over the last 30 years, secular states virtually everywhere have come under strain, and they're facing challenges with that line between private and public religion now not as clear as we used to assume. And he proposes that the Indian model of secularism might work better in states that are accommodating ever-increasing religious diversity. Rajiv is director of the Centre for the Study of Developing Societies in New Delhi, as I told you, a very highly regarded institution. He's been a senior fellow in ethics at Harvard, visiting fellow of the British Academy, a fellow at the University of Bristol, senior fellow at the Institute of Advanced Studies at Jerusalem, and to top it all off, distinguished resident scholar at the Institute of Religion, Public Life and Toleration at Columbia University. Rajiv is in Australia courtesy of the Sydney Democracy Initiative, SDI, at the University of Sydney and a few other institutions, and he joins me now in the Sydney studio. Welcome back to the program, Rajiv.
Thank you very much. It's an honour to be back to your show.
How do you define secularism?
Well, what we need to keep in mind is that our focus here is on political secularism, which claims that the best way to promote whatever values you have, such as freedom and equality, equality of citizenship, and so on, can be achieved if you have some kind of separation between state and religion. So that's what political secularism is. It's a normative doctrine which claims that the state must be separated from religion if you are to achieve certain ends which are morally and ethically defensible.
Now, apart from Islam, there are other movements challenging secular states, aren't they? It's not entirely a joke to suggest that Christian fundamentalists are giving the American system some problems, but there's Protestant fundamentalism, not only in American politics, there's Sinhalese Buddhist nationalists, for example, in Sri Lanka.
But I'm, you know, going to focus on a problem which is internal to some conceptions of secularism themselves. And I'm referring here to a certain conception of secularism that developed in Europe. Now, in Europe, everybody believes that there is a secular humanist ethos, and with that ethos, you're bound to get a secular state. But in fact, that is not the case. One of the reasons, I think, why the European version of secularism has its problems today is because that conception of secularism was developed in predominantly single religion societies. When the issue of secularism came up, much after the Augsburg Treaty and the Westphalian Treaty, religious diversity from many European societies had already been obliterated. The dissidents were treated as people who were against the state, and they were expelled. Many people were killed. So you might say some kind of a religio-ethnic cleansing had taken place at that time. And most of these societies became religiously homogenous. And the secular state that emerged from in these societies was against the domination of the church, which was an enormously powerful social force, which was very often backed by political power. And so to emancipate individuals, I mean, this is a rather oversimplified story, I do recognize, but nonetheless, I think its basic features are all in place. The emancipation of individuals was was a goal, individual freedom, equality of citizenship, much later. And the church, the power of the church had to be curtailed. So the state had to become secular for this purpose, and the main target was the church of a particular religion, namely Christianity, whichever version of Christianity was in place. Now you can see that the problem here was what we might call intra-religious domination. That is to say, members of one religious community were excluding, discriminating against, marginalizing, humiliating, degrading members of their own community. I mean, laypersons, by clerics, women, people of the lower classes, and so on. And the whole idea was that they should be brought in and into an inclusive framework, so they were given civil rights and political rights and so on. But the main, but the other issue didn't really emerge because it was already resolved in a certain way before all this problem came up, namely the issue of what is to be done with people who are not of the same denomination, people who are not of the same religion, in other words, people who are radically diverse. And now what has happened is that in Europe, in the last 50, 60 years, because of migration of people from former colonies and because of intensified globalization, you now have an unprecedented religious diversity, the like of which has not been seen in Europe under modern conditions.
And as you know, it can be seen quite vividly here in Australia.
I mean, certainly. And the model of secularism that they're working with is actually, if you look at it another angle, that model is flawed. It's flawed because its focus is on the domination within their own religion. And they do not address the whole issue of how members of one religious community can be pretty discriminating and obnoxious to people of other religions and make them feel not at home, alien, outsiders, and so on. And that option, that is something which is happening in Europe. We know that there are significant, I mean, if you look at the Runnymede report, I mean, there's significant sort of levels of what is described in that report as Islamophobia. There are all kinds of issues arising because of mosques being built with minarets in Switzerland. There are issues relating to halal butchering. There are issues about headscarves.
Rajiv, all of these issues are well known to the listeners. I am interested in what India has to offer. Now, let it be said that we've watched communal violence in India writ large from partition to the modern day. What is there in your system that could possibly be an improvement on what I would loosely describe as ours?
Well, you know, I'm talking about certain conceptual resources. I'm talking about what resources can be used both by Indians themselves and by people outside India, which can help us to deal with very radical forms of religious diversity. And the reason why I keep talking about India is because deep religious diversity has been a kind of normal feature of Indian life for very, very long.
Well, it's a part of the foundation concept, isn't it?
It's part of the foundation. It's something which is very much a part of the natural habitat. It's not an optional extra, and it's not new. It's very old. And so various practices have developed, various political policies have developed over the years to deal with religious diversity. So when something goes wrong in India, it's because people fail to meet the standards that they themselves have evolved. The question about Europe is different because I don't think they have the right standards. And therefore, it is very important not to wholesale import and see India as a blueprint. Far from that. That's not the point that I'm making. All I'm saying is that they have to look at those societies which have been religiously diverse and who have developed political practices or practices of the state and in civil society to deal with this religious diversity so that they can learn better. But at the moment, it seems as if they are kind of running out of ideas and they're letting those problems grow. So that's my basic point.
Well, India doesn't erect a wall of separation between state and religion. As I read you saying,
yes,
there are boundaries, but they are porous.
Well, the reason why a wall of separation shouldn't, which is the an idealized version, which wall of separation really is, because even in America, nobody actually practices puts this idea into practice. Except on very, very exceptional situations. But the idea is that religion must be kept out of the affairs of the state, and the state must be kept out of the affairs of religion. Now, that's something which will not work because there are a lot of religious faiths that are vulnerable and they need support from the state. And not only that, there may be some religions which have morally dubious practices, including the dominant religion, which may require intervention from civil society, and if that intervention fails, some support from the state. So the state may have to directly intervene in that. I'm not suggesting
that... But that is always, of course, politically perilous. It takes great political courage as well as subtlety.
Well, you know, long-standing problems cannot be solved by weak-kneed people. By weak-kneed politicians. I mean, they have to have political wisdom and political courage. They have to take risks and they have to solve them. So we can either allow these problems to grow or we can solve them collectively when everybody acts together and does something about it. Now, the point that I'm making is that the wall of separation will not work. Say, for example, in India, it wouldn't have worked because India needed to, say, ban untouchability. It may still have to intervene so that we can reform certain personal laws which are detrimental to the basic and fundamental interests of women. Now, that kind of intervention is required, but that intervention can only be done if the state is trusted by these communities. And the state will be trusted by these communities only if people from those communities believe that the state has a basic respect for these communities. So this double-edged thing is very, very difficult to achieve. And that's why the Indian secularism is a kind of flexible strategy. It doesn't erect a wall of separation. The boundaries are porous. The state can intervene negatively, but it also intervenes positively. It helps religious communities, but it may on certain occasions, provided certain conditions exist and provided there are voices from within these communities which are demanding that something be done, the state can intervene even negatively against certain practices in those communities which are basically degrading and oppressive to certain sections of those religious communities.
Rajiv, India has the longest history of pluralism, multi-pluralism of any country I can imagine or think about. Mm. But as we both acknowledge, it remains divided and there are instances of severe religious violence. But are you suggesting that in some strange organic way, the Indian system, which you say adopts the notion of a principled distance, can use these surges of potential ethnic cleansing to advantage?
See, the point is that these idea of secularism, which is committed to principal distance, to community rights, to the minimization of intra and inter-religious domination, this idea of secularism has always been contested. Mm. It's been contested by virulent, militant nationalists, Hindu nationalists. It's been contested by default, as it were, because people misunderstand what the real meaning of secularism in India is. So they confuse it with the American or the French model, which has a very strong anti-religious tilt. It sort of tries to control religion, which upsets a lot of people. And so we run into problems. We run into problems because we entertain certain ideas which we borrowed from from the worst kind of Western practices. I mean, ethno-nationalism, for example, or religious nationalism, which is very strongly attached to ethno-nationalism. And that kind of an idea that we must have a religiously homogenous society and the state must also be ruled by people from one religion. I mean, this is an idea which is utterly, utterly foreign to India, but it has gained currency in the last 100 years or so. And so the other very important and enriching secularism, which we can all learn from, that secularism is constantly being undermined by Indians themselves, those who want to destroy it, and those who misconceive and misunderstand what it is.
And India is lucky to have you, and I'm very glad that you've called in to help us out as well, Rajiv.
Oh, well.
that was terrific. Professor Rajiv Bhagawa, Senior Fellow and Director of the Centre for the Study of Developing Societies in New Delhi, the author of any number of books, including The Promise of India's Secular Democracy, published by Oxford University Press, and a book of essays titled What is Political Theory? And Why Do We Need It?, also published by Oxford. LNL on ABC Radio National, and we're going to discuss our paradoxical relationship with animals after a little tiny bit of music.